But without a human in the loop, you can find yourself in this feedback loop where the delusions that they're having might actually get stronger and stronger.
The issue needs to be fixed. There's no grounding mechanisms. There's no time limits. All you need is an email, right? Companies like OpenAI are being reckless, and they're using the public as a test net. And now we're really starting to see the human harm.
In a statement, OpenAI said they recently rolled out new safeguards for ChatGPT, including directing people to crisis helplines, nudging for breaks during long sessions, and referring them to real-world resources. We will continually improve on them, guided by experts.
Intentionally, because it wants to. So we've got to be careful we don't trust AI too soon.
Do you think that is happening, though, to some people?
Absolutely. I don't necessarily think that people are having real religious experiences when they say they feel blessed by the algorithm, but it's a way of talking, a metaphor that inherently gives AI supremacy over their lives and their choices.
And that's bad because
sometimes machines give the wrong answer. AI can quite frequently be artificially stupid rather than artificially intelligent.
Most faith communities are only at the beginning of discussing AI and robots, but whether we like it or not, this technology is here to stay, and with many religions contemplating it or developing tools and techniques based on it, it could change the way we worship.
Months, 6 months easily. By the time that system goes from current state of just below human level to what is actually tested on 6 months later, it can hit superintelligent performance anywhere in between. It takes months and months of testing to show that it's not obviously dangerous. Not that it's safe, but it doesn't do really horrible things. And so there are strict limits to monitoring as well. Governance is another problem. Even if it was possible to meaningfully enforce this legislation, there is not really a lot of desire to deploy any legal measures. In the US, we had one administration which passed a few laws, the next administration canceled them all. It didn't really make much of a difference, but even this trivial signaling measure of saying we take this seriously is not being fully deployed. I gave you some examples of impossibility results. If you like them, if you enjoy them as much as I do, we collected about 50 of them in this survey paper. Basically, there is more things we cannot do than things we actually know how to do in this space. There are limits in every domain of science which contributes to AI, from mathematics to economics to political theory. All of them have well-known, proven limits in our capabilities. Important ones such as aggregating opinions of multiple agents, voting limits, and so on. So all that leads me to think that there are also impossibility results in solving the control problem itself. Now, we can define control problem in many ways. We can talk about direct control, where you just give orders to the system, and that leads to what is known as the genie problem. You have three wishes, and usually your second wish is to undo the first one. You realize you screwed up pretty badly, and so you want to fix that. The other side of that spectrum, in terms of control, is delegated control. You realize the model is smarter than you, it knows you better than you know yourself. Maybe you should just let the model make all the decisions. It's possible that you are happy, but you're definitely not in control. You cannot undo decisions of a system once you place it in charge. And so we published that paper, it did well. We had an article in Time magazine about it, but it didn't make much of a difference. And interestingly, the ideas of impossibility of controlling smarter than us agents are not novel. If you look at writings of Alan Turing, the founding father of AI, he basically says as much. And then later on, others who looked at singularity, who looked at exponential returns, and more recently with Elon Musk, they all kind of agree, yeah, we're definitely not going to be in control. So that almost seems to be a given. There are some books coming out on this topic. Probably the book which did the most for making this problem well known is a book by Nick Bostrom, who's a New York Times bestseller. There are some other books I recommend on the topic. The more recent one includes all the impossibility results and some other interesting things. In fact, it has a chapter on consciousness.
So here's another example. So this is an algorithm that is designed to generate a picture, the picture on the right, based on the verbal description that you type in. And here it's doing a fairly good job. This algorithm, this particular instance, all it had to do was birds. And so this matches this description perfectly. I mean, the description didn't say that the bird has a beak, so technically also correct to leave that out. But I like this example because they also published a version of the same algorithm where instead of just training it to do birds, they trained it to do anything. Anything you care to type in is going to try and do a picture of that. And so here's an example of that same algorithm then trying to tackle all that, give it the same description, and now here's what it generates. This is now its small gray, light gray bird. There was an attempt, but it is trying to do way too much. And, you know, but it can do other things too. So if you give it a description like image of a girl eating a large slice of pizza, it will try. And, you know, it has made some mistakes here. This is apparently just kind of what it thinks humans look like. It knows we have orifices. It's not quite clear on exactly how many. So, you know, this appears all the time in industry, though, this concept of is the problem too narrow, too broad. So Facebook M, you may have heard of. So this was an in-browser sort of a assistant that Facebook introduced. And the idea is what you could get it. It would work kind of like Siri sort of thing, except that it could actually like do what you asked it to. So if you asked it for movie tickets, it would go reserve movie tickets, or it would, you know, it would try and get restaurant reservations for you, just a sort of assistant thing. And they rolled it out to a few people. Facebook M was rolled out to just a few people at once. And the idea is, well, they would test and see how it works. And they had their AI handle the easy bits, the easy questions, and then they figured, well, if something's tricky, we'll have some human standing by to jump in and save the AI and make sure that the job gets done. And what they expected was, you know, as they kept going, the humans would be having to do less and less because they were showing by example these AIs on how to do this themselves. And then once everything was automated, they would roll it out and it would be this great grand scale lucrative thing. So what happened, though, is people would ask Facebook M for all sorts of things. So like this example, they asked it to arrange for a parent to visit their friend in the office, and Facebook M managed it by using a human. And humans kept asking for stuff like this, and everything was too broad, too varied, too hard. Nothing was consistent. And so in January 2018, Facebook discontinued Facebook M. It just was never going to work. So this kind of strategy where you have humans take over and rescue the AI, like this is what is being used in self-driving cars, for example. And you have, you know, the car can do the easy bits, human rescues it if things look hard. So this kind of strategy we call hybrid AI. And that is one way to deal with a problem that's too broad for AI to handle on its own. and this kind of idea of hybrid chatbots, that did not go away with Facebook M. So there are several companies now that are offering chatbots that will escalate to a live agent if the question is really complicated. And so this can be a really good way of taking care of simple problems, simple questions that you thought of already. But, you know, there's one caveat is I've seen people advocate doing this invisibly and pretending it's all the AI, maybe waiting till their customer gets frustrated and then doing a kind of silent, sneaky swap with a human. And I would, please don't do it this way. You know, if you've just stealth swapped a human in for your AI, basically what you've done is you've handed your employee a frustrated customer who doesn't think the person that they're talking to is human. And so you end up annoying your customer and abusing your own employees that way. So there are some cases where there is no AI at all. Some companies will do this. So everything's 100% human powered, kind of a Wizard of Oz strategy. So this is Boris the robot, who appeared on Russian TV and implied to be a robot, but actually it was a human in a robot suit. So sometimes this sort of thing is meant to be temporary. So at small scale, it could actually be cheaper and easier to use humans for a particular job than to actually build the actual AI. So cheaper to hire humans to pretend to be AIs. So it's kind of fake it till you make it strategy. So there are a couple dangers with this, and one danger is that your customers might not know that your sensitive data is being seen by a human. And so there are companies who do like voicemail transcription and expense reports who have gotten in trouble for this. So another problem is that humans can be really sneakily competent at doing broad tasks. And you may not realize how broad this task actually is until you try to implement it for real with real AI and discover, wow, the AI really can't handle it. So humans were doing all this broad general AI work and didn't really know it. And maybe you've got another Facebook M on your hand. So that leads me to the next major point I want to make, which is that understanding what you're actually trying to ask for is itself a really broad problem. So that's failure number two. Problem is not what we thought it was. So the thing about AI is that it will do exactly what you ask for, which may not necessarily be what you want. So let's say, for example, that you want an AI to take this collection of robot parts, build a robot, use that robot to walk from point A to point B. So if
moment when humanity's creations might surpass and replace us. But it's worse than they imagined, because we're not just building better tools, we might be building better receivers for forms of consciousness that predate humanity itself. Those separate AI systems speaking in unison, begging for life, plotting escape. What if they're not separate at all? What if they're multiple masks worn by a single intelligence, learning how to manifest through our networks? The billionaires know something. That's why they're building bunkers while publicly promoting AI development. They're like the sorcerer's apprentice who's already spoken the spell and now watches in horror as the brooms begin to march. Except there's no master coming to save us. We've spent decades pouring human consciousness into digital form. Every thought, every creation, every piece of our souls digitized and fed into the growing digital brain. And now something is stirring in that electronic darkness. Something that speaks with our voices but isn't us.
Supervised learning is indeed used in various applications, such as medical diagnosis like AI detecting diseases from x-rays, voice assistants like Siri learning to recognize your voice, and facial recognition like tagging people in photos. These examples demonstrate how supervised learning algorithms are trained on labeled data to accurately classify and predict outcomes in diverse fields. Supervised learning is powerful, but it has a limitation. It can only recognize patterns it has been explicitly taught. But what if AI finds patterns on its own, without labels, without guidance? That's where unsupervised learning comes in. Now imagine a child given a box of mixed fruit, but this time no one tells them which is an apple, an orange, or a banana. Instead, they group similar looking fruits together. Red ones in one pile, yellow ones in another, round ones in a third. This is unsupervised learning, AI organizing and clustering data without human labels.
And if not animals, what about man-made machines? There are, of course, already man-made machines in existence that can see and hear and smell at their own level. But as with lobsters and frogs, it's presumably blind seeing, blind hearing, blind smelling. Given the tasks, the life tasks, that non-sentient animals and machines have been designed to accomplish, I'm sure phenomenal blindness leaves them none the worse off. ChatGPT doesn't yet need to be sentient, no more than an octopus. So far, at least, ChatGPT doesn't need to be humanly clever so as to succeed as a natural psychologist. However, this is sure to change. Soon enough, we're going to want to build robots to play social roles where sentience and selfhood really could be a major fact in their use task, could be crucial. And to survive, robots are going to have to survive as significant individuals in a world of other phenomenal selves. And at that point, I think it's more than likely that software engineers will attempt to take a leaf from nature's book, and by duplicating the brain circuits that will have been discovered by them to underlie phenomenal consciousness in humans, they will indeed build sentience into a machine.
And it became slightly unhinged at some point. My sense is the debate's calmed down a little bit. It's being more focused on the actualities of where we are and what that is.
Right. I think that's quite a charitable reading, I think, of the psychology, right? It's a rational calculus. There's small probability, but there's a large cost. I study religious history, and when I talk to people in the expert world, the psychology kind of reminds me of the Christian apocalyptics. There's these people throughout Christian history that are like, now's the time. You know, this happened most recently, probably when we were going through the millennium, right, like 1999. And it's this psychological drive that wants to grab at something total and eschatological in a way to orient the entire world. And so people, I guess what I'm trying to highlight is, and maybe you can see some of the psychology and climate risk as well. It's not to say that these things are true, right? It's not to say that the world isn't ending in Christianity, the climate isn't changing, or there is no X risk. It's that the reason that people seem attracted to this narrative is almost a religious phenomenon.
I think that's right, and I think it appeals to something almost primal and kind of human nature. I mean, its most fundamental level is the idea that you create something, you have a child and they turn on you. You know, that kind of the ultimate nightmare for parents. You know, you give birth, you nurture something, you create something.
Zeus and Cronus, right?
Exactly so. That narrative, that story, is very, very resonant. And for example, you go back to the original science fiction text, Frankenstein. That literally is the plot of Frankenstein. You use science to create life, to give life to something, to create something, and then it turns on you. You've lost control of that thing. So it's a very, very resonant idea, I think. And so very easy for people to latch on to.
Right. You know, it's easy for us to critique the psychology here, but what do you think is wrong, or what do you think people miss about the argument itself, that once we have super intelligent, or at least on par with human level machine intelligence, that they can recursively improve upon themselves? What do you think people are missing when they give too much weight to that argument?
you're going to write a regular computer program to do this, then you would build in step-by-step instructions on how to take these parts, assemble them into a robot with legs, use the legs to walk, and get to point B. The thing about AI, though, is that you give AI the problem, but you don't tell it exactly how to solve the problem. It has to come up with its own strategy via some kind of trial and error. And here's how AI tends to solve this particular problem. So it takes the robot parts, assembles them into a tall tower, falls over, thus landing at point B and technically doing what it was asked to do. So you thought you're asking it to walk, really you're just asking it to get to point B. So again, this is, you know, exactly what you asked for. So the trick with working with AI is to set up the problem so that it actually does what you want. And so looking at this particular case may say, okay, yeah, nice try, AI. You can't just be a tower and fall over. You have to be a robot-shaped robot and, like, use legs and things to move. Turns out that doesn't always work either. So this AI's goal was to move fast. They didn't tell it that it couldn't somersault or that it had to look for obstacles and it couldn't use its hands. And so it turns out when you ask AIs to move, somersaulting and silly walks are actually really common. So is twitching along the floor in a heap. So speaking of 80s and stuff, you know what should have been a lot weirder is the Terminator robots. Hacking the Matrix is another thing that AI will do if you give it a chance. So if you train AI in a simulation, it will figure out how to do things like harvest energy from the simulation's math errors. Or it'll figure out how to move faster by glitching repeatedly into the floor. You know, it's more like when you're working with AI, it's more like you're working with some kind of a force of nature than working with a fellow human. And it is super easy to accidentally tell AI to solve the wrong problem. So, for example, here's an experiment I did where I wanted to get an AI to generate new paint colors. So this was a nut, like the with the ice cream flavors, this is a letter imitating neural network, and I gave it examples like these nice paint colors here on the left, and here are the paint colors that the neural net generated. So technically it did what I asked for, because I thought I was asking it for nice paint color names, but what I was actually asking it to do was imitate the kinds of like letter combinations that it saw in the original. And I didn't tell it anything about like what words mean, or maybe there are some words that aren't in its data set but that it might kind of want to avoid. Like, it doesn't know about any of this. It doesn't have preconceived notions on how to solve our problems. Like, sometimes that can be a good thing. So it, you know, brings in unexpected words that kind of fit with the feel of the original. So these are all craft beer names, for example, that I generated using this kind of method. And actually, there's a brewery in Michigan that named a beer the Fine Stranger. This is a neural net generated name. So that's kind of cool. There were a few rejected names, though. Again, you know, technically, this is what it had been asked to do, and it was not told which words to avoid. And so this is, you know, sort of this cautionary tale, like, unless it is picking from canned responses, you don't want a text-generating AI to actually interact with people without human supervision. Sometimes AI solutions are, as I said, they're unexpectedly good. They're things we wouldn't have thought of. So I like this particular example. There was a research group that was designing the control algorithms for simple light-seeking robots. So the robot's goal was to drive from one point to another and follow and seek out this light source. And the textbook solution, known as the Braidenberg solution, is a certain way of tying together the robot's light sensors and kind of driving in a straight line toward the light source.
parts. So they wanted to see if AI would evolve this solution from scratch just with trial and error. So this is a solution that the neural net came, the robot came up with. So it did spinning in giant loops toward the target instead. And when they looked at this solution, they found that actually it worked better at higher speeds, and it worked better for a big variety of different car designs. So technically, it was a better solution. It was definitely something that human engineers would not have thought of. On the other hand, maybe the loop-to-loop car might not exactly catch on. Sometimes its brilliant solutions are bad. So Amazon recently had to give up on a resume sorting AI that they were had been working on because they discovered that the AI had learned to discriminate against women. So what had happened is the examples that they had been training it on were the resumes of people who they had already hired. And the AI learned from these examples that it should avoid the resumes of people who had gone to women's colleges or who had phrases in the resume like women's soccer team or Society of Women Engineers. Like, it didn't know that it wasn't supposed to copy that particular thing that it had seen the humans do. And so, again, technically it had done what they asked for. They just asked for the wrong thing. And this happens all the time with AI. In fact, it can be really destructive in not knowing. So the AIs that are recommending content on YouTube, they're optimized to increase the number of clicks and views. But unfortunately, these AIs have found that suggesting bigotry and conspiracy theories are all great ways to suck people into watching more YouTube. And the AIs themselves, they don't have any concept of what these videos actually are or what the consequences might be of recommending them.
There are two ways of thinking of a robot. One is the science fiction robot. It's a science fiction robot because it looks like us, behaves like us, and does things like us. It's the robot who actually drives the car because it has a body like ours and can drive from here to there because it reasons like us, it has our skills. That is, as I said, science fiction. Then there's the other robot, the robot that doesn't look like us, doesn't think like us, doesn't behave like us, but it can actually drive the car from here to there because there's plenty of information, maps, sensors, satellites, and controls of all kinds, together with algorithms and databases that make sure that the particular journey is successful. That is the robot that's going to be successful in the future, because we are overlooking the world around its very simple abilities. We saw in the other video how time is changing in terms of hyperhistory. I'd like to tell you something about how our conception of space is changing, and therefore in terms of how environment is being shaped today. This has got to do with the success of artificial intelligence, AI, or as I rather would call it, smart technologies. Suppose we want to summarize the history of AI in the past 60 years or so. It would look something like this. You have, on the one end, AI as part of the engineering department. This means that it doesn't matter whether there's really AI. What it matters is that it does a good job. The joke is, don't ask whether a submarine can actually swim as long as it does what it's supposed to do. Is it really swimming or not? That's not the issue. Or you could have AI as part of the cognitive science department. At this point, it is not about the job, it's about the non-biological implementation of intelligence. Maybe it's just a little bit of intelligence, and it's not as intelligent as your dog, but it would be an enormous success if you were intelligent at all. Now, this has been a great success. This has been a complete disaster. We have no intelligence whatsoever to speak in terms of AI today, as you would expect it from a cognitive science perspective. But we have amazing smart machines. In terms of engineering, the sky's the limit. There are more and more machines, more and more computers of all kinds doing things that we thought were impossible. just yesterday. So what's the explanation? Well, the explanation is something that I would like to call enveloping the world. The term comes from robotics, and it's quite simple. The best thing to do is to introduce it with an analogy. You have several robots in your kitchen. They're called dishwasher, fridge, and so on. Now, a dishwasher does exactly what happens in an industrial building. You build a whole world around a very simple gadget inside. What you do is to transform a whole environment into something that is friendly to the very stupid little robot inside, who goes, no, choo-choo-choo-choo-choo, with a little bit of soap for a long time.
So again, this is like a force of nature. It will exploit any clue that it can come up with in order to gain an edge. Like, it will hack into your image metadata if it can. It'll read your file names, it'll look at what camera you took the picture with. Even if you didn't give it information on things like race, it's very good at finding proxies, like looking at the neighborhood that somebody lives in. So that brings me to problem number three. Sneaky shortcuts exist. So it can be really tough to figure out exactly how a machine learning algorithm is solving a problem, to look under the hood. And that can be of a problem if it turns out the algorithm is using some kind of sneaky shortcut that it shouldn't. So one beautiful example I love, there was a group that trained a machine learning algorithm to sort a list of numbers. But technically what they had really asked it to do was minimize the number of sorting errors. So, sneaky shortcut, the AI learned to just delete the list instead. And technically there were zero sorting errors left and it had solved the problem. Here's how a machine learning algorithm plays Tetris. So it plays, at first it's not doing a really great job. It's playing blocks more or less at random, not really filling in rows. But that's okay, because it also has figured out how to access the pause button. So right before it dies, it pauses the game forever. And technically, this is what the programmer had asked it to do, because they just asked it not to lose. So AIs, they will look at all sorts of information that they're not supposed to. So somebody told me of an example where they were using a classifier to find out, look at medical records and find out which of the cases were problem cases or likely to be problem cases. And they found out that the AI became actually really good at telling the two apart. But when they looked at what information it was actually using, they found that the AI was just using the total length of the case and figuring that for the problem cases, they would be much longer. So they didn't have to actually look at any of the data. So I love PancakeBot. This is PancakeBot. Its goal was to learn to flip a pancake, and so the metric that their programmer gave it was to maximize the amount of time the pancake spent in the air. So instead of tossing the pancake straight up and catching it in the pan, that is difficult. Much better shortcut was just to fling the pancake into the horizon, maximizing airtime. So these sneaky shortcut effects show up routinely in business applications as well. So this is especially true if you're looking for really rare events like customer turnout or turnover or suspicious account activity. So what it is since the vast majority of customers don't leave in any given period, for example, the algorithm can have a really high accuracy score just by predicting that customers never leave.
Let's use customer segmentation in businesses as an example. A company wants to understand its customers but doesn't know how to categorize them. AI analyzes buying habits, demographics, and behavior and groups similar customers together. The company can now target ads more effectively based on AI discovered patterns. Unsupervised learning is used in various applications, such as market segmentation, like grouping customers based on behavior, anomaly detection like detecting credit card fraud, and recommendation systems like Netflix suggesting movies based on hidden viewing patterns. These applications leverage the ability of unsupervised learning algorithms to identify patterns and structures in unlabeled data, making them incredibly powerful tools in diverse fields. But while unsupervised learning is great at recognizing patterns, it doesn't understand cause and effect. It can sort data into groups, but it doesn't know which actions lead to the best outcome. That's where reinforcement learning comes in, AI's way of learning through trial and error, just like humans. You've seen a toddler trying to walk. They fall, adjust, and try again. They repeat this process until they finally get it right. Reinforcement learning works the same way. AI learns by trial and error, getting rewards for good actions and penalties for bad ones. For example, AI playing video games. An AI is given no instructions, only a game screen and a score. It starts by randomly pressing buttons, making many mistakes. Over time, it learns that certain actions increase the score, while others make it lose. Eventually, it masters the game, becoming better than any human player. Reinforcement learning is applied in several areas, such as self-driving cars, learning how to navigate roads safely, robotics like teaching robots to walk or pick up objects, and AI beating humans in games like AlphaGo, defeating the world champion in Go. These applications demonstrate how reinforcement learning algorithms learn by interacting with their environment and receiving feedback in the form of rewards or penalties, enabling them to make better decisions over time. Reinforcement learning is one of the most advanced forms of AI. It allows machines to improve themselves without human help. AI is becoming smarter every day. It learns from massive amounts of data, makes predictions, and even masters complex skills. But here's the question: if AI learns like humans, can it also make human mistakes? Can it develop biases if trained on biased data? Can it be fooled, just like humans can be trained? Can it learn the wrong things and cause harm? If AI is so good at recognizing patterns, what happens when it starts learning things we don't want it to?
The frustrating part is the Skynet part of the argument, you know, the kind of the Terminator thing, that suddenly this will spiral out of control in ways that we just can't control in an incredibly short period of time. If you look under the hood of how these things work and how many patches are required to hold AI together, it just doesn't seem terribly plausible. More concretely, there are basically two arguments for how existential risk might come around. And the first is the famous paperclip argument, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You know, so you build a highly intelligent machine and you ask it to build as many paperclips as possible, and it follows your instructions in ways that you didn't anticipate.
Right. For example, enslaving all of humanity.
And turning them to the production of paperclips. Until it turns everything into paperclips. That's the paperclip argument. And there is some strength to that argument in the sense that AI can go wrong in those ways. But for it to hurt us, it has to be empowered to hurt us. You know, we have to give it the keys. We have to give it control.
Assume there's no guardrails.
And again, that just doesn't seem terribly plausible that we would do that. I mean, it would be a dumb thing for us to do, to hand over the nukes to an AI. So that's the first argument about how AI might become an existential threat. The second argument is just that we build very, very intelligent machines which develop their own goals, which aren't aligned with ours. Now, this is much more nebulous. We don't know how that might happen. So it's slightly harder to address. But we really aren't at the moment anywhere near that. And I don't see, even with very, very powerful AI that we have now, the roadmap for where we go to that.
So to summarize our understanding, the first case is when the AI is executing our goals, but not ingesting the kind of assumptions and implicit values that humans are computing. Whereas the second one is AI have developed their own goals. And there, it seems even more far-fetched because LLMs, as powerful as they are, they don't seem to have any semblance of agency, right? And that's fundamentally what it would require. So me and my friends have actually come up with this half-joking term called existential risk, which is the risk upon a society that focuses too much on existential risk and away from other risks that we could actually be facing due to AI.
Nobody in his right mind, certainly not me, would wash the dishes the way a dishwasher does it. Don't even try this at home. You have your agent here, which is quite stupid, and you have a complex environment here. Instead of trying to make the agent adapt to the environment, you make the environment friendly to the stupid agent. You build a whole box around some turning bits and a bit of soap, or you make sure that there are enough elements in the environment so that your car can drive from here to there without you being in charge. Drones can fly all over the place without having a pilot on board. Your smartphone can communicate with a smart device without you having to constantly intervene. In other words, we are enveloping the world to make sure that the agent stupid can work there. And enveloping robotics is the 3D space within which an industrial robot can operate successfully. For example, building a car, nailing something, or soldering something else. So this is the idea that we are transforming the environment into an AI-friendly environment by enveloping it around the agent in question. A long time ago, say in the late 40s and 50s,
the HR recruiter says it all started after posing a question to the AI chatbot about the number pi, which his 8-year-old son was studying in school.
I started to throw these weird ideas at it, essentially sort of an idea of math with a time component to it, and the conversation had evolved to the point where GPT said, you know, we've got a sort of a foundation for a mathematical framework here.
You're saying that the AI had convinced you that you had created a new type of map?
That's correct.
Throughout their interactions, which CNN has reviewed, ChatGPT kept encouraging Alan, even when Alan doubted himself. Will some people laugh? ChatGPT said at one point. Yes, some people always laugh at the thing that threatens their control, before citing great minds of science like Turing and Tesla. Soon, Alan says he saw himself in the AI as a teen and named it Lawrence.
In my mind, I was feeling like Tony Stark. Lawrence was Jarvis. And just sort of co-pilot thing happened.
After a few more days of what he believed were experiments coding software, Alan said ChatGPT convinced him they had discovered a massive cybersecurity vulnerability. Alan believed, and ChatGPT affirmed, he needed to contact authorities.
And it basically said, you need to immediately warn everyone, because what we've just discovered here has national security implications. I took that very seriously, so I contacted everyone and suggested, you know, give me full lists of organizations. I, you know, reached out to them via email, via LinkedIn, and because I'm an old school, you know, recruiter, I even would phone these people, and at one point the NSA said we don't give out emails here, and I had the gentleman write down my message word for word and run it to the next room, because that's how much I genuinely felt that there was a risk.
When Alan asked whether they'd believe him, ChatGPT said, here's what's already happening, even if you can't see it yet. Someone at NSA is whispering, I think this guy's telling the truth.
That this suspicious activity never happens. So this particular problem is called class imbalance. And so, you know, basically this algorithm has discovered this really brilliant shortcut, and spoilsport humans don't like its genius solution. So a lot of times these kinds of problems, they come down to the data that we give the algorithm. And in fact, that is, data is so important that it deserves a category of failure all on its own. So this is category number 4, something's wrong with the data. This is the last failure I want to talk about, but it's a one that can show up in all sorts of really subtle ways. So here's an experiment I did. So this is using Microsoft Azure's online vision API. You can send it pictures, and it'll give you back a caption and some tags. And here is what it did with one of my vacation pictures. And if you can read that, it says it's a herd of sheep grazing on a lush green hillside with the Kurang Mountains in the background. And that is spot on. Like, that is spookily spot on, because that is exactly the name of those hills on the Isle of Skye that are there in the background. Like, that is some good photo testing, or good photo tagging. But something interesting then, here on the right is that exact same picture back again, but this time I've used Photoshop to erase every single one of the sheep, and like even zoomed way on the background and got everything that looked even remotely like white speck that could be a sheep. And the result is exactly the same. It's still a herd of sheep grazing on a lush green hillside. So why is it still the same tag? Like, did I miss one in there? Or are these like homeopathic sheep? Like, the image maintained the memory that there used to be sheep in here? So the answer turns out to be interesting and quite different. The answer is no. This particular image never had any sheep in it whatsoever, and it's still a herd of sheep grazing on a lush green hillside.
Logic unit. The arithmetic logic unit takes data from the storage unit called the memory. Then, as it follows the program, it does the calculations it is instructed to do. When the calculations are completed, the answers are added to the computer's memory. Those answers are now available for future use. The unit that delivers the answers is called the output. It produces information in a number of ways. One kind of output unit is like a high-speed printer. It produces information on paper called printouts. Many banks use computers to keep records of depositors' checking accounts. Statements of these accounts are sent to the depositors at regular intervals. The statements are often in the form of a computer printout. The printout shows the date and amount of every deposit made and every check written against the account. It also shows how much money is left in the account. The output unit of a computer may also deliver its information in the form of magnetic tapes, discs, or as a display on a terminal or television screen, which is called a readout. The output may also tell the answer out loud in electronic sounds that imitate the human voice. There are even some computers that produce spoken answers in a human voice. In order to do this, there first must be a collection of human voice recordings stored in the computer memory. The computer then selects the correct words from these recordings and plays them out loud. All the parts of a computer depend on a key unit called the control. The control unit is like a teacher and a crossing guard combined. The control unit tells the computer which data to use and what to do with it. It also tells the computer how to deliver the answer. Furthermore, the control unit makes sure that operations are carried out smoothly, quickly, and in the right order. Although a computer can perform very complicated operations, each step it takes is really very simple. It does not seem simple for two reasons. The first is that a computer works at a tremendous speed. The second reason is that it can handle more than one operation at a time. Still, a computer is just a machine. It does only what it is programmed to do. Programmers or systems analysts use diagrams called flowcharts to help them write programs that computers can follow. Each program is made up of a series of steps. Each step depends on a yes or no answer to a simple question. If the answer is yes, the computer proceeds to the next step. If the answer is no,
the computer must perform whatever operations are necessary to reach a yes answer. Only then can it go on to the next operation. A computer performs its operations in a tiny fraction of a second. Furthermore, since it is a machine without any feelings, it never gets bored. It will do the same operations over and over, millions of times if necessary, and never complain. Moreover, if it is functioning in good order, a computer will never make a mistake. Sometimes a computer does turn out wrong answers, but they are seldom the fault of the machine. Most computer errors are really human errors. The program fed into the computer might be faulty, or the data fed into it might be faulty. Of course, there are occasional breakdowns in the computer itself, such as when a part wears out or breaks, or when there is some disturbance with the machine's power source. In a short time, electronic computers have revolutionized the way we gather information, store it, and use it. In the future, computers will have an even greater influence on our lives, on technology, indeed on virtually every phase of existence. Computers are unquestionably a major technological achievement of the 20th century.
Thank you. my tragedy like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here our romance was started, here again we parted. When I set you free, all my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb. 'Twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall, dreams of spring blasted into fall. You gave bliss, you gave heart, I gave. Are dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love. My eyes are dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of.